Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the GAS programme and senior fellow at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by two of my OIS colleagues, James Henderson, who's director of the newly formed Energy Transition Research Initiative, and Anupama Sen, who's senior research fellow at the OIS and also deputy director of the initiative. Now, the OIS has been writing about energy transitions for a number of years now, but the Institute is increasing its focus on this area with the launch of an Energy Transition Initiative, which will see research being focused on a number of specific areas. So, Jim, I wonder, would you like to say a few words about this?
Sure, David, thanks. Yeah, as you've mentioned, the Institute's been covering energy transition issues for a number of years in the oil programme, looking particularly at the future of transport, in the gas programme, looking at the future of decarbonised gases, and in the electricity programme. Well, most of the electricity programme's work has been based around transition issues. But what we thought would be important would be to bring that together under one umbrella, the Energy Transition Initiative, and also to focus on some specific areas where we can create expertise, if you like, within the Institute and provide that expertise to our sponsors and benefactors. And some of those areas are the future of hydrogen, the geopolitics of energy supply chains, and the circular energy economy, where we're going to be looking specifically at those topics in a lot more detail. But overall, it's basically bringing together all the energy transition research within the Institute under one umbrella.
Fantastic, Jim. Thanks so much indeed for that overview. And may I also welcome our second speaker today, Anupama Sen, to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
We are here today in this extended podcast to discuss the key conclusions from your recently published paper, The Energy Transition, Key Challenges for Incumbent and New Players in the Global Energy System. Now, just to timestamp this podcast in the ever-changing world of the energy business, we're recording it on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 8th of September, 2021. So moving on to the report itself. Jim, can I come to you first? You know, can you share with us what is the general context and background for the report?
Well, I think the general background is that the IPCC report on climate change, which was published in August of 2021, reminds us all rather starkly that human activity is responsible for global warming. And of course, the energy sector is right at the centre of that. Now, a number of countries and indeed companies have been announcing net zero emissions targets, which have emphasised not only the unparalleled levels of investment that are going to be required in the energy transition process, but also the huge amount of international cooperation that is going to be needed, and the fact that this transition really is a huge challenge. Now, for hydrocarbon exporters and for kind of incumbent players in the existing energy system, this can present something of an existential threat. I mean, we only have to look at the electricity sector over the past decade to see how much turmoil there's been there and how companies that previously were hugely strong players have been dramatically weakened as their businesses have changed. Of course, for others, both incumbents and for new players, there are plenty of opportunities as well as we develop new technologies and new energy systems are built up. And so what we thought we'd do at the Institute is to try and provide a conceptual framework within this report to look at those challenges, to see how they affect the entire energy value chain and the players all the way along that chain, and also the countries and governments who are going to be involved in critical decisions about implementing policy and regulation.
Okay, so Anupama, perhaps I can come to you now, because there have been a lot of scenarios modelled for the energy transition over the past few years, and I wanted to ask you, how important are they and can any general conclusions be reached from them?
Well, David, scenario analyses are useful as they provide a picture of potential pathways to meeting net zero targets. And in our paper, we've looked at some recent scenarios which are compatible with the 1.5 degree target, such as the IEA's net zero emission scenario, the IEA sustainable development scenario, and the IPCC 2018 scenario report. Now, the most obvious general conclusion is that the demand for all hydrocarbons falls across all these scenarios while the overall share of renewable energy increases. And depending on which scenario you're looking at, this changes as to when this happens. But there are a number of less obvious conclusions as well, and I'd like to highlight three. The first is that there is significant variation across regions, and the energy transition may refer to very different outcomes in different world regions. So if we look at the IEA Sustainable Development Scenario, in North America and Europe, coal almost disappears from the energy mix, and it's replaced largely by renewables. By contrast, although coal declines in Asia, it remains a significant part of the mix, and it's replaced by gas as well as renewables in the two decades to 2040. And then if you look at the Middle East, hydrocarbons continue to account for over 75% of the energy mix, even in 2040, with gas again playing a role while renewables also enter the system, largely at the expense of oil. The second sort of conclusion that follows from that is that although hydrocarbon consumption will go into sharp decline over the next 2 to 3 decades, according to these scenarios, there still appears to be a significant level of demand during that time because of these regional differences, which means that abatement will be a critical requirement even as the demand for hydrocarbons goes into decline. And a sort of final, less obvious conclusion is that you have to look at the demand side as well. So according to one of the median cases in the IPCC scenarios, total primary energy demand in 2050 is almost at the same level as it is in 2020. But by then, the population will have grown by about 2 billion people and the world's GDP will have doubled or more. So it's very clear from that that improvements in energy efficiency must also continue to play a key role in reducing per capita energy demand.
But Ali Palmer, you know, presumably the impact of the energy transition will also be felt across the whole of the energy value chain. So how are players in each of the areas going to be affected?
Yeah, that's a great question, David. So for instance, if we start at the top of the value chain and we take the extractive industries, the obvious ones are obviously hydrocarbon producing and exporting companies and countries, which must address issues around the possibility of being unable to monetize their reserves, the risk of stranded assets, lower prices for their exports and products, questions around whether they should be committing to new long-term investments, and of course, that option of diversifying into new non-carbon intensive business areas. But in the upstream, there are also those producers of rare earths, minerals, and other materials required for the clean transition, where new opportunities are emerging with significant consequences for economic growth, trade flows, and also wider geopolitical influence. And then if you move further along the value chain, systems of energy conversion and supply are also facing important changes. So we've seen this in the power sector, where the increase in intermittent renewables has raised issues around balancing, decentralization, and pricing as the electricity system adapts to this new decarbonized world. And hydrogen is emerging as a possible new source of converted energy and indeed an important potential link between the decarbonizing gas and electricity sector. So there's a lot of implications there as well. If we move further down the value chain, of course, we come to the delivery of energy and infrastructure. And we know that there are questions there around repurposing, stranding, and other sorts of questions. And finally, at the interface between supply and consumption, there are important issues, including things like increasing consumer choice, demand-side management, and the development of new decentralized sources of supply in combination with new digital technologies. So it is indeed a widespread impact across the entire supply chain.
Okay, Jim, you know, can I come back to you? Because you know, as companies develop their strategies for the energy transition, they will be facing multiple issues and challenges. Now, you highlight a number of these in the report. So why don't we go through them and discuss some of the key themes? Let's start with policy and regulation, which you certainly see as a key driver. Why is that, and what are the implications?
Well, David, previous energy transitions have really been driven by competition between fuels. So, you know, we've seen coal emerge to replace wood and biomass. We've seen oil emerge and then gas. And essentially, it's been the efficiencies driven by those, the introduction of those fuels that have driven their introduction. Whereas this is more about a market failure. It's about the failure of the market to price in environmental externalities, particularly the impact of CO2. And that has taken state intervention and therefore policy to drive change, because initially, at least, the cost of the replacement energy sources has been higher. It is falling over time, but it's been higher. And therefore, state support has been required. So policy is right at the heart of this change. And that raises a number of key questions. The first of which is, you know, what are the targets that are being set and what type of targets are being set. Are they for levels of renewable electricity? Are they for other forms of decarbonized energy? Or are they just outright bans on the use of hydrocarbons of whatever type? The second area really concerns fiscal policy. So what costs are being imposed either on industries or on consumers? What incentives are being provided to encourage the shift away from the existing energy system to the new decarbonized system? And I think that the question of international trade is also a very important one, because clearly if different countries and regions impose different levels of costs and provide different incentives, then there's always a risk of carbon leakage. And we'll talk about that later, but that also needs to be addressed through policy. You've also got the question of market regulation and whether existing markets can in any way help to manage the change. So, one example would be the IMO rules for use of fuels in marine. Another example might be whether the third energy package in the European gas market is suitable for the introduction of hydrogen, which is a higher cost fuel and would struggle to compete with methane. So therefore, policymakers may well have to intervene to sort that out. Overall as well, there is just the question, which again we can come to later, of whether markets can actually, catalyze the transition, or whether governments may ultimately be forced to pick winners. Now, in a theoretical economic sense, that's nobody's best option. But given the time constraints that we have around the energy transition, we may have to accept the fact that that could become an alternative if we get towards 2030 and into the next decade and significant change has not been made. So policy and regulation right at the heart of the energy transition.
And of course, another factor that's right at the heart of it as well is the development of technology, which certainly seems absolutely critical if we're going to meet climate targets. So Anna Palmer, perhaps you can share your views as to what the key issues are as you see them on this theme.
Well, there are a number of ongoing technological developments that we've seen that continue to push new barriers. And that's in existing technologies like solar and wind, which we've seen continue to improve in cost and in scale. But at the same time, we've seen new technologies to decarbonize the energy system that are being developed, like short-term storage, like batteries, and long-duration energy storage technologies, such as chemical storage, ammonia, hydrogen, and others. And also technologies such as carbon capture, use, and storage, which may need to play a role if the global economy's reliance on fossil fuels continues for longer than anticipated. And a breakthrough in one or any more of these could have significant consequences for the energy transition, but there's still some uncertainty over which technologies will be developed to economic and commercial scale. And as Jim said, an important issue pertaining to this relates to that debate over promoting technology neutrality versus governments picking winners, giving the world's remaining carbon budget. But regardless of the outcome of that debate, for each of these technical developments, there is a need to understand the current and future cost trajectories, the drivers underpinning any cost reductions in order to assess whether these are sustainable, and also to try and gauge what the key risks and uncertainties are around technologies, and what type of government support may be required and for how long. So these are some of the issues around the development of technology, which we discuss in greater detail in the paper.
But of course, another issue is paying for the new technologies and also the kind of shifts in infrastructure will be required. And these are huge questions, particularly in the developing world. So, Jim, what are the key issues here? How do you see them being addressed?
Well, so the amounts of money involved in the transition are not surprisingly enormous. I mean, IEA estimates that we're going to need to spend between $1 and $1.3 trillion per annum in the power sector, another $1 trillion improving energy use in end-user areas, and then a further $0.6 to $0.8 trillion on traditional fuels such as oil and gas in order to ensure a managed decline and a managed transition to a new energy system. So now there's some hope that a kind of post-COVID-19 recovery might see monies invested in, certain countries and regions like the EU have already announced packages to encourage both economic recovery and the shift towards greener energy. But despite that, the mix of private and public funding that's going to be required is enormous. And banks and other financial institutions are going to have to take really a dual risk. they're going to have to decide whether they want to finance new technologies and take the risk that those technologies may or may not work. And they also need to decide how rapidly hydrocarbon demand is going to go into decline, and therefore whether they want to finance oil, gas, perhaps coal projects as we look to the future and there is a risk of stranded assets. So I think the key issue is going to be, you know, how do investors, banks, financial institutions, equity investors, perceive the risk profiles for the various investments as we go through, and finding that balance and therefore getting the investment story right so that we have a managed transition rather than a chaotic one is going to be a real challenge.
Now, Anupama, perhaps I can come back to you because about the kind of energy networks, because the transformation required in energy networks will also be very significant and could involve repurposing as well as construction of new energy transport systems. So I wondered, how is this going to be managed and how will it all impact the energy transition?
Well, David, the sort of the dominance or the prevalence of hydrocarbons across the world so far has seen the development of this network of pipelines, grids, shipping fleets, and even distribution outlets, which have all become a core asset base in the global energy system. And if you look at electricity grids, for instance, which were established to optimize the delivery of power from a centralized supply system across to a diverse range of industrial, commercial, and residential users, All of this infrastructure will need to be adapted or repurposed, as you've pointed out, if it's to remain relevant to a decarbonized energy sector, which is seeing the emergence of new energy vectors that don't necessarily conform to the traditional centralized system. And so, as you've said, the most obvious risk is that older and less adaptable assets could become stranded. But there are arguments for repurposing networks, which have been made on the grounds of preventing a significant loss of economic value and enabling an efficient transition. We see examples of some of these debates in some sectors. So the gas sector provides an example of the issues around infrastructure, where the proposed introduction of hydrogen raises questions around blending with natural gas in the current system, replacing gas with hydrogen while repurposing current pipelines, or even constructing new hydrogen networks and so forth. In electricity, the issues are around expanding the grid or using it more efficiently. In the oil sector, it's a little bit different. There's an issue around whether existing oil infrastructure can be repurposed or whether it will ultimately become redundant. But indeed, there is a perspective which is referred to as energy system integration, where this is one mechanism where you can achieve efficient decarbonization through the development of physical and regulatory links between different energy infrastructures to allow the optimal use of storage, supply, and backup generation in the system. So these are very complex issues, and the resolution of these issues will require clear regulatory frameworks around the optimal use of existing infrastructure, new infrastructure, and potentially also greater cooperation between key players across the value chain.
And of course, these are issues which we will be addressing as part of the Energy Transition Initiative within the OIES. But one thing that I wanted to come back to, Anupam, if I can, is kind of what about consumers? You know, how will they be incentivized to change? And also, how do you think their role will change in the energy transition?
Yeah, well, this is really one of the issues that is at the core of the energy transition, consumers. And we've seen that consumers may require incentives to switch away from fossil fuels towards zero carbon alternatives, but that alternatives that are rational or optimal from an environmental and economic standpoint may not always be preferred by consumers because of many factors such as cost, convenience, and this happens even when governments try to provide incentives to enable consumer choice. You don't always get the desired outcome. So many suppliers of energy will be considering, alongside policymakers, what types of incentives consumers may best respond to and whether new products and new services will be needed to create differentiation in order to gain market share. And indeed, many types of new players could emerge to meet the requirements of this changing marketplace. And examples include aggregators, service providers, and retail companies, which could all be set to take a more prominent role in the energy transition. And it will be interesting to see whether incumbent players can adapt to this element of the energy transition, or whether companies that are more used to consumer-facing business models actually start to prosper more.
Okay, but what about consumers, particularly in developing countries? Jim, perhaps I can come to you. You know, how will the concept of energy justice be addressed? And could this be a stumbling block at COP26, for example?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when one's talking about consumers, it's very easy where we sit in Oxford to kind of focus on consumers who already have access to reliable sources of energy and how they're going to be impacted. Of course, as the IEA has highlighted, there are 2.6 billion people in the world that don't have access to clean cooking appliances. And there's about 770 million with no electricity supply. And that number may well have gone up by 100 million or more thanks to the pandemic and people's just inability to pay. So one can't think about the energy transition purely as a disruption to the existing energy system. One has to think about it in the context of, almost a third of the planet's population wanting access to energy, as well as needing to respond to environmental pressures. I mean, we also have to bear in mind that there are about 5 million excess deaths a year caused by air pollution, the majority of that happening in non-OECD countries. So again, one has to take all these factors into consideration. On top of that, developing countries are quite naturally saying to developed countries, you guys have caused most of this problem. If you need us to fund change, then you're going to have to help by coming up with some support. And $100 billion per annum was promised under the Paris Agreement in 2015, $100 billion per annum by 2020. Now, that's not being delivered at the moment. And that is one of the areas, the provision of that funding is one of the areas that's going to be a major topic for debate at COP26. And indeed, if it's not resolved, could cause a huge problem for getting a resolution at the COP.
Jim, can I stay with you and ask, what impact will this have on the business models of companies operating in the energy sector? Presumably, dramatic change is expected, or is this already taking place?
Well, it's already taking place to an extent, David. I mean, looking at some of the major incumbents, perhaps the IOCs, we're seeing many of them take big strategic decisions under pressure from investors and banks, turning themselves into integrated energy service companies rather than international oil companies. At the moment, there seems to be something of a split along geographical lines. The European companies are taking this very seriously. US companies have been a bit behind, although just recently shareholders at ExxonMobil and Chevron have made their feelings felt. And so those companies are having to change now as well. Obviously, we've got to think about national oil companies as well, who are more focused on the specific production of energy within their countries, often hydrocarbons. They are not moving quite so rapidly, although some are pushing towards a more decarbonized future as well. But essentially, we're looking at a pretty radical change in their business model as they have to decide whether their current business model really has any life at all over the longer term. And if it doesn't, where's the shift going to come? Many are looking towards electrification and the electricity sector as a specific diversification strategy. And others are looking at getting much more involved with the consumer rather than sort of the wholesale market. And those are two major changes for their business models. Essentially examples again from the electricity sector are being seen. I should probably let Anu Palmer talk about electricity because that's a very good example of how those shifts have been made.
Well, Anupam, coming to you then, because you discuss the circular economy strategies in the paper. So could you elaborate a bit more on that for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely, David. This is also something we've written about at OIS. Another issue around business models pertains to companies' own net zero goals and the adoption of circular economy models, which basically involve the decarbonization of companies' supply chains to achieve this. And the consumer is a huge part of this, actually. So corporate circular economy models have been developed and implemented within organizations for many decades with the aim of improving short to medium term efficiency. And now this approach has evolved over time to include the aim of environmental sustainability and a move from linear to circular supply chains within organizations, allowing organizations to decouple financial growth from a dependence on finite resources. So fundamentally, circular economy strategies aim at the more intensive use of an existing stock of resources. And in order to achieve this, these strategies include things such as resource life extension, material reuse and recovery, and the adoption of new service-based business models rather than business models which transfer ownership of a good or product to the consumer. As such, this can both reduce environmental impact and also create new and more sustainable value propositions and new revenue streams. However, In order to gain credibility for these new models, it will also be very important to see increased transparency from businesses and from countries requiring accurate measurement, verification, and reporting of the emissions from these reorganized supply chains and reorganized business models. And that's also something that we've written about at OIS and something that we need to continue developing and monitoring.
Okay, so Jim, can I come back to you and ask perhaps a kind of concluding question? Only, what are the overall conclusions on the challenges facing the companies as the energy transition progresses?
Well, I think they've got to ask themselves a few big questions. The first is, how rapidly should they change? I mean, one of the big risks here is we don't really know how fast the transition is going to go. So do you cannibalize your core business now to create first mover advantage, or do you wait, stick at what you're good at, and try and generate some excess profits as others pull out of your business? That's the first question. The second is, you know, how do you put in place preparations to move fast if you need to? There must be a chance that policymakers, if faced with a crisis, suddenly change the rules of the game very rapidly. And if you're a company, you need to be ready for that. Allied to that, then, do you need to think about the flexibility of your business and whether you want to keep your core functions together or whether you want to split your business in two, have a kind of traditional existing business and then a new, more modern business? And we've seen examples of that in the electricity sector already. And then finally, I think the bigger challenge is that the energy system is becoming much, much more interconnected, both between suppliers, traders and consumers, but also across the value chain between the electricity sector and the gas sector, between the electricity sector and the transport sector, and in terms of provision of mobility from electricity companies. There are all sorts of ways in which the value chain is integrating in different manners. And so companies, again, have to be flexible there and ready to adapt to what consumers want and what policymakers tell them they need to do. So lots of different challenges, I think.
So how are energy markets going to react to these changes, you know, and what impact could that have on the energy transition? And I also wonder, can markets really catalyze the transition process, or will more state intervention be required? And I think it'd be useful to maybe answer this question by talking about fossil fuels and then talk about electricity. So, Jim, would you perhaps address first fossil fuels, and I'll come to you, Anna Palmer, on electricity.
Sure. Well, I think the first answer is, in one word, is volatility of prices. I mean, we're already seeing that right now. We've seen very, very low prices in oil and gas markets during the pandemic, and now we're seeing significantly higher prices as we see economic recovery, but a kind of slowdown in investment and a supply availability. And I think that story could run through the entire decade because of the levels of uncertainty I've talked about, and because therefore of the reluctance of major energy, oil and gas companies, and indeed banks, to finance and invest in supply that could become surplus very rapidly and could become indeed stranded. So I think that the volatility around hydrocarbon prices is going to be a key theme. I think the impact of carbon prices is going to be very, very important. We've seen a rise in carbon price, which obviously can act as an incentive to shift away from hydrocarbons towards renewable and decarbonized sources of energies. So, you know, how is that going to work? We don't have carbon prices throughout the world. I mean, the EU has been leading the way. China and the US have also been making progress. But of course, where there are carbon prices, there can also be carbon leakage as companies decide to shift. So we need to think about whether markets can address that issue, or whether it will take policy interventions like the one we're seeing in the EU with a carbon border adjustment mechanism. And then I think finally, the question around markets is around the introduction of new, more expensive fuels. One might take the gas market as an example, where you've got methane, which is obviously currently dominant, but the potential introduction of hydrogen, which at the moment certainly is a higher cost fuel. Can markets really deal with that transition without some level of policy intervention? And I think that comes back to the question we raised at the beginning, which is whether markets can deal with the transition, can catalyze and facilitate the transition on their own, or whether we are going to have to see more state intervention. I think that's an open question, but I think our sense at OIS is that as in the electricity sector, there is going to have to be a significant amount of state intervention to get the transition to happen at the pace we need it to happen to meet our climate targets.
Okay, so Anna Palmer, can I perhaps come to you then and ask, you know, how will the electricity market react then?
Well, as Jim's already sort of touched upon this, the electricity market and indeed the electricity sector has sort of been at the frontier of the energy transition so far. So we have seen a lot of these effects already over the last few years in the electricity markets. And despite having a liberalized electricity market model that was developed in the OECD and then adopted in many non-OECD countries, we have seen significant state intervention with government incentives provided to aid the uptake of solar and wind energy, for instance. And we've seen that disrupt the operation of wholesale electricity markets because you see intermittent renewables with high capital costs but zero marginal costs introduced into a market that was originally designed for fossil fuels with a very different cost structure. So we've seen these problems, but we've also seen solutions evolve to address them. Because although this has created price volatility in electricity markets and issues for suppliers of dispatchable power, that we've seen things like capacity markets introduced to resolve this issue. And so there are ongoing innovations and solutions that are being tested in electricity markets. But having said that, the ultimate model of the decarbonized power market is yet to be determined. We don't know what that is. And therefore, we are going to have to continue to monitor the evolution of markets as well as different sorts of government instruments, like the role of auctions, long-term contracts, and other things as the transition progresses. So I would say it's all still taking shape.
And again, repeating, that is exactly the research we're going to be carrying out at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies over the coming months and years. Jim, can I come back to you? Because, you know, we've talked about different regions having different starting points for the transition, as well as different strategies for decarbonisation. What are the key themes in this debate, and what could the overall impact be?
Okay, so a number of key themes. First, if you look at the top 20 emitters of CO2 in the world, 9 of these sit below the threshold for being called developing countries, and a 10th, Russia, is basically defined by the UN as a country in transition. So in terms of their prioritisation, it's not to say they won't prioritise decarbonisation at all, because it can be an engine of economic growth, but clearly economic growth and improving the socio-economic, foundations of their countries is going to be a priority for them, perhaps ahead of environmental issues. So they're going to need financial support to incentivize them. And we've talked about the levels of financial support that have been promised but not delivered, and whether that will be an issue at COP26. Secondly, the starting point in terms of energy mix for various regions is very, very different, as Annie Palmer has pointed out. So, you know, just to take an example, Europe and US have fairly balanced energy mixes, so a move towards renewables can be done within a diversified system. But when you look at the CIS, there's a dominance of gas. In the Middle East, there's a dominance of oil and gas. And in Asia, coal dominates. And that creates problems around moving away from relatively cheap sources of fuel that provide jobs and economic growth towards more expensive and less immediately stable forms of energy. So I think you've got that question. And then you've got a security of supply question as well. I mean, some countries are going to want, importing countries are going to want to move away from hydrocarbons towards renewables, but others are going to be less incentivized to do so, again, depending on what their energy mix is today and how they see that changing and how they see the security of supply risks emerging. So basically, I think the bottom line is, the dynamics of the energy transition are going to be driven by the different starting points of different regions. And I think another issue to raise is that as we talk about the decarbonisation of the energy system, we can't really do this without thinking about the impacts on hydrocarbon exporters as well. Because although it's very easy to say, well, we just need to shift away, we really need huge amounts of cooperation in this area as well. And you can't just ignore the fact that some countries are heavily reliant on hydrocarbon revenues. You can't just remove that source of revenue and hope that nothing will happen or hope you won't get pushback. So again, I think that's, you know, one needs to take the starting point of exporters into account as well as consumers.
Okay, so Anupam, can I come to you? Because I want to ask about the impact, you know, in different sectors. Now, I presume that some are going to be harder to abate than others, and also the change will happen at different speeds. So is that assumption correct? And if it does lead to any, will it lead to any major issues? What do you think?
That's a good question, David. And I guess the answer depends on what sector you're looking at. And obviously, the main focus of decarbonization to date has been the power sector, where you introduce renewable energy to displace hydrocarbons. And that's the most obvious and early route to decarbonization, as it provides significant emissions reduction. But the next step being contemplated by all governments, or most governments, is the electrification of other economic sectors. And while this approach will work to decarbonize some sectors, it may not be sufficient for what we call hard-to-abate sectors. So, for example, heavy industries are hard to abate because they require high-temperature heat, and they have significant process emissions, which basically result from the feedstocks and the chemical processes that are used in these industries. And these cannot be abated solely by a switch in fuels. They require changes to industrial processes, changes to furnace design, and so forth. And these industries are also very highly integrated. So a change in one part of the process has to be accompanied by changes to other parts. So that's one sort of sector that you look at where you see what the challenges are. The transport sector is another example. And I'd say it's not exactly hard to abate, but rather it's late to abate, because convergence has been very slow around technologies, governance, and regulation that's required to abate emissions in this sector. So within transport, while electricity is expected to become a much more prevalent form of energy for passenger road transport and urban freight, various other forms of liquid fuels, for instance, produced from renewable and synthetic decarbonized sources, will also continue to be consumed, for instance, in trucking or heavy goods freight. And the use of gaseous fuels like hydrogen could also provide an additional alternative over time in areas, again, such as heavy goods freight or even shipping, for instance. And of course, we have sectors like aviation, which again might need to look at other solutions, including reducing or managing passenger demand. So there is a variety of solutions and a variety of challenges within these sectors. And that's why the speed at which these sectors decarbonize might vary. And we have to look at solutions beyond simply a change in the fuel. We have to look at management of demand, and we have to look at more at circular economy strategies as well.
Now, given the huge changes that we're talking about and the differing positions of many countries, you know, the impact of the energy transition on politics as well as economics, you know, must be significant. So, Jim, you know, what do you see as the major geopolitical consequences that we should anticipate? And also, can we identify the winners and losers?
Well, then, I think, as I alluded to in my last answer, I think one needs to question whether the whole concept of winners and losers is a useful one in this context. Because unless we all cooperate and work together, you know, we're not actually going to get anywhere. This is a global problem which requires a global solution. So just thinking that some people are going to lose and just leave them to lose is not really going to be very helpful. Having said that, you know, it's certainly easy to say that hydrocarbon producers and exporters are going to be losers, and those who are importers who can shift to renewables could rapidly become the winners. We think it's a little more subtle than that. There'll certainly be challenges for incumbent producers, but they have opportunities. Those that who can prosper can be low-cost suppliers or also producers of energy with a low carbon intensity. So there can be a focus on that from existing producers. Also, they can develop technologies to decarbonize their production. I mean, Anu Palmer's already alluded to methane leakage, which needs to be addressed, and to CCUS. And these are two major topics that hydrocarbon producers can pick up and run with to ensure that they can extend the longevity of their product, if you like. However, I think you can see two other major shifts. One is in the supply chains for existing fuels. So I think we would anticipate the flows of oil and gas changing over time, when take gas in particular. You know, Europe, as it decarbonizes, is probably going to be seeing lower demand for imported gas, whereas Asia, with the switch from coal to gas, is going to become a much, much more important player. So one's going to see shifts in the flows of existing energy sources and supply chains and production. And then in terms of the new energy, there is going to be an increasing focus on the supply chains there, both for the materials, minerals that are required, but also the processing and the management and the construction of things like solar panels and windmills and the entire supply chain around, if you like, new energy for the energy transition. So again, we're seeing China pick up that baton and become very focused on becoming a leading player, both in terms of development of technology, but access to the resources needed to produce those technologies. The US has been a bit slow, but is catching up. whereas a country like Russia has really not taken the transition particularly seriously at all yet, and has therefore lagged behind. We'll see whether that has a bad political effect, but certainly if they carry on with their current trajectory, that's not going to work well. So I think that, you know, although we need collaboration, there clearly is going to be competition as well, particularly in the supply chains for the development of new technology for the energy transition.
Okay, now, you know, as we come to the end of this podcast, and I always like to finish with a kind of broad future-looking question. So given all the topics that we've discussed today, you know, what are your overall conclusions on the key issues facing incumbent and new players in the energy transition? So Anna Palmer, why don't I come to you first for your views?
Well, I think I would have three overall conclusions here. First, the speed of the energy transition will be influenced to a great extent by how it's financed in terms of the availability of capital and the allocation of that to areas which can bring about the fastest reductions in emissions. And obviously, incumbent and new players face opportunities and challenges in this regard. Second, I'd say the energy transition is not just a supply side discussion. We have to consider the critical role of the demand side as well, as the entire paradigm of production and consumption around which the global economy is organized. And therefore, sustainability will be a key feature of all players' business models in the energy transition. And third and final, as technologies reach commercial scale, issues around regulatory convergence and governance are likely to become very important for all players.
Okay, Jim, so giving you the final word, what are your kind of views on that?
So I think my first conclusion is that the energy transition is a process. It is not a one-off event. And as part of that, if the process is going to be managed, then I think inevitably hydrocarbons are going to, albeit in decline, are going to be part of that process. And therefore, abatement technologies to ensure that any use of those hydrocarbons is effectively mitigated is going to be vital. So I think CCUS is going to have a huge role, even though some see it as greenwashing by the hydrocarbon industry. I think more and more people are realizing, and more scenarios that are being painted are highlighting the fact that it's going to have a massive role to play. And hydrocarbons will have a role, albeit declining, over the next 20 to 30 years. I think Anu Palmer's point about consumers is vital. I think that consumers are going to play a bigger and bigger role here, and companies are going to focus more and more on them as the system really becomes much more integrated. The difference between supply and demand is going to shrink, if you like. And then finally, I think that in terms of cooperation and financing, those two questions are going to be absolutely critical. Countries and regions cannot go it alone because this is a global problem, and therefore there is going to have to be huge cooperation. And the first sign of that, whether we can do that and whether we're successful, we can be successful, is going to be seen at COP26. And I think the question of financing that Anu Palmer raises will be vital at COP26 if we can find a way to provide the finance for developing as well as developed countries to move forward. Then I think we've taken the first step in the right direction.
Well, Anu Palmer and James, thank you so much for your time today. And I really enjoyed our conversation that summarizes the key messages from the recently published report, The Energy Transition, Key Challenges for Incumbent and New Players in the Global Energy System. Now, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. And may I draw your attention to the Energy Transition Initiative page on the OIS website, where you will find this and other academic papers, reports and articles of interest as they are prepared over the coming months and years. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.